This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, a show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this March 18th, 2023. Today's show is being taped in advance of its airing on the 18th. But let me tell you what we're going to do. So the first half of today's show, it's going to be a lot of updates and things that are relevant in the news and health news these days. In the second half of our program, I'm going to bring back an interview we did with Dr. Charles Cavo. Dr. Cavo is the director of Pounds Transformation in West Hartford and Southington. And the reason I want to bring here and replay that interview, you know, his operation there, he is a medical doctor, and it is a multidisciplinary effort to get people to be healthier, eat healthier, exercise more, and really work within your boundaries. So it's not just a weight loss program. And the reason I'm bringing it back on is because there is an article published this week. Again, I mean, again, we're hearing this time and again from multiple studies on how diet influences your risk of dementia, something that we're all interested in and concerned about as far as our longevity goes is, and our, more importantly, our quality of life. So, we're going to replay that in the second half of today's program. Our COVID positivity rate in Connecticut is about 4.5%, which is pretty good. And I'm here in Florida right now where it's about 9%. But what's interesting is we're 3 years into this pandemic now. So when you think of March 11, 2020 was the first time it was declared a pandemic. And really, right now, we're at what everybody considers a tolerable level. And there are reasons for that. But how tolerable is it? There are 900 to 1,000 deaths worldwide per day, about 400 in the United States. And there are about 7 million people have died worldwide related to COVID in the last 3 years. Our problem is that over this time, trust has eroded in public health. And that's a real problem because this virus will mutate. Other viruses will come and become more virulent. These viruses are learning how to adapt. And if we don't have trust in public health, we're going to be especially vulnerable. Today, what we're doing, so why is this tolerable right now? Well, the last 3 years, we have learned a lot. We've learned how to better monitor for other viruses coming by monitoring the wastewater. And we have had the good fortune of being able to develop vaccines quickly and effectively. So very safe vaccines are available. It's really because of over the last 3 years, we've had vaccinations distributed worldwide, and many of us have acquired immunity from being infected. So we've made a lot of progress in the last 3 years. Let's not go backward. And part of that backward mentality is politics. Let's face it. If somebody says the sky is blue, there's another party saying it isn't, right? And that's how basic it's become if we pay attention to politics. What we need to do is pay attention to science. And our public health officials from that standpoint. March 18th, 1864, this day in medicine, Dr. Karl Schlatter was born. Now, Dr. Schlatter was a Swiss surgeon, and in 1897, he performed the first gastrectomy. He removed a patient's stomach. And in doing so, right, he attached their esophagus to the intestine. So basically, he performed the first gastric bypass, right? So here we are, right, 126 years later from when he did that first surgery to doing it fairly regularly. So we did it for many years for people with stomach cancer. But now as weight loss surgery, we're doing the same thing, the gastric bypass that he first did back in 1897. Except now, I wonder what he would think about, such a big operation, and now it being done with a scope. Right? So using scopes and not being as invasive, yet we're still able to perform the procedure that he pioneered. The other thing Dr. Schlatter became famous for is something many people will notice is the Osgood-Schlatter disease. He described that in 1903. That was basically inflammation of the patellar ligament. So in the knee, at the base of your kneecap, there's a ligament that attaches to the bone, the tibia, and becomes inflamed and has a painful bump. Usually it occurs on both sides. And it's frequently seen in people who do a lot of jumping. So those of us in the area of sports medicine see it a great deal in young basketball players. Very painful, but gets better with rest. And we think it has something to do in young children who play basketball with the growth plate and the growth process. Something I wanted to also mention this week, Mitch McConnell. The senator and speaker in the Senate, leader of the Senate, Republicans, he had a concussion as a result of a fall in a hotel room. And I think it emphasizes that as we get older, we become much more vulnerable to falling and loss of balance. So a lot of people say, well, why is this? Well, the reason is that as we get older, right, our brain gets smaller, atrophies, and especially at the cerebellum where we keep our balance. You need really three things to keep balance. You need your vision to pick up visual cues, right, looking at walls and where you are in space. You need the nerves in your feet because you feel pressure. So if you're on an incline or not, you will feel that pressure in your feet and know, especially if you're on a rough surface or hiking. And the third thing you need really is your inner ear. When you remove any two of those, you become more vulnerable. So, for example, if you have some neuropathy where you don't feel things as well in your feet and you're getting up to go to the bathroom in the dark at night, there's a good chance you need to hold on. And that's why we emphasize to older people, start making changes in your home. Start using night lights and things such as this. And if you're on uneven surfaces, say it's at night, you're going to a barbecue or something, make sure you have something to hold on to. Even if you have to bring a cane, if you're someone who's vulnerable to falling. Because we all dread not only hitting your head or suffering a concussion, but also breaking a hip. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to discuss a couple of more topics that have been relevant in the literature this past week. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Welcome back to Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we are going to be playing a repeat of an older interview later on in the show with Dr. Charles Cavo from Pounds Transformation. In case I forget, for people who hear the interview and really want to get in touch with Dr. Cavo, His information is at poundstransformation.com at 860-906-1289. While we're on the subject of Pounds Transformation and transformation in general, and another thing that's come into the press is Weight Watchers has now gotten on to the trend of using diabetic medications as appetite suppressants. Most recently, the use of Ozempic. And what has happened is Weight Watchers is very famous for really working with patients and with clients to adapt to better eating habits and try and an effort to lose weight with a support mechanism. They used to have groups that met. I'm sure they do it really on the internet now. But what they've done is gone out and purchased a telemedicine company that specifically was working with clients to get them on some of these medications that work as appetite suppressants, most notably Ozempic. So they have now gotten into that and provide that as a service to their clients. So I found that interesting this past week when that came out. You've heard us speak on this program a lot about migraine headaches, and we've had guests on, well, specifically the most crucial of those guests being Dr. Bilczyk. And Dr. Bilczyk has talked to us a lot about migraine and the use of CGRP antagonists, calcitonin gene-related peptide antagonists. And they were originally just injectable. These are drugs you use for migraine because they interrupt that cascade of events that causes migraine. Migraine being defined as a headache, typically throbbing on one side of the head or could be on both sides. And the headache is typically accompanied by other symptoms, nausea, light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, things such as that, that last between 4 and 72 hours. So the injectable CGRP antagonists now are available orally, right? And we see that in the form of Nurtec and Ubrelvy. But now, this past week, a new nasal spray and nasal application called Savagipant. Savagipant, again, is will be available in July 2023. And this, again, is a CGRP antagonist, a monoclonal antibody that interrupts this cascade. And in two placebo-controlled trials, and again, regular listeners know that that is the true test of a drug in phase three. They looked at over 1,400 participants at 90 locations throughout the United States and found that the drug versus the placebo was much more effective. So for those who do not want to use an injection and want to get rapid onset. So again, a nasal spray is a more rapid onset than a subcutaneous injection or an oral tablet can start using this medication. We're going to keep an eye on it. As I start using it and others start getting experience with it, we're going to keep an eye on that medication. You know, you're very familiar with the time change debate. We've talked about it on this program, and it comes up every time we go to daylight saving time, which we did last week. But I think it has to be foremost in our mind. The effort to get to permanent standard time is crucial because it's based in science. As I mentioned, I'm in Florida right now, and here there is a movement where people want to stay on permanent daylight saving time. And that is led by Senator Marco Rubio, who now reintroduced the Uniform Time Act, which was introduced last year and was actually defeated. And What is gaining support is just the opposite, and that being the effort to go to permanent standard time. And many states are pushing toward that. And I think in Connecticut, we need to make a similar move. And the reason being, so the advocates for daylight saving time are saying, well, it'll get more people to eat at restaurants, be more active, and in Florida, more people will go to Disney World. I have to tell you that that has not necessarily been proven out as being a huge economic boost. But I'll tell you what has been proven is that permanent standard time is most similar to our natural light, right? The natural rhythm of light. And in doing so, that is what our cells and our brains are based on. We're not changing that. Morning is crucial. Light becomes essential to set our human body rhythms, right? So our rhythms for the day. Everything is rhythmic. And that's how the body works. We also know that bright light boosts mood. So people who suffer from seasonal affective disorder, right, they recommend using a particular frequency of bright light lamps periodically during the day, especially in the morning. But one of the biggest arguments is not an economic one, and I've heard that from farmers and other people, but it's about our children, adolescents. And the reason is because in puberty, the melatonin is secreted later at night. So we are all familiar with the fact that teenagers have a different sleep pattern than everybody else. They go to sleep later, wake up later. Unfortunately, that has fallen on deaf ears once again with our educators because they keep starting school earlier and earlier when students are still asleep. But the point here being that with puberty and in the teen years, melatonin, which we all are familiar with in terms of being able to help you fall asleep, right? People take it with gummies and any other way of taking it. So melatonin in our brain is secreted later at night as they get into the teen years. Therefore, these young people are falling asleep even later with daylight saving time. And in doing so, they're even more asleep in the morning when they have to get on a school bus in the dark, all right, to go to school while it's still dark. Especially in communities that are on the western portion of the time zone. So with that, there has been discussion, at least in New England, because it's up to the states, really. There is no federal mandate that possibly we need to lead the country. Possibly New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, maybe New England states need to band together and say, listen, this is what we're going to do, and the rest of you guys can figure it out. I think that would be a big push, and I think we need to get to that point. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with an interview, a replay of an interview with my guest, Dr. Charles Cavo from Pounds Transformation. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080.
Who can take a sunrise?
Who can take a sunrise?
We're back on Healthy Rounds. Your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And during our break, I got a good question from Jeff, came up and reached out to me at info@alessimd.com regarding the last story, the last discussion about lecanemab. And the question was, what does it cost and will Medicare pay for it? And we do not have answers to that. So far, it's only been used in trials. So during a trial, people don't pay for the medication, but that's a really good question as to whether or not it's going to be covered by Medicare. And that will keep everybody informed as we get that information. Also, since we last spoke a few minutes ago, we've had two commercials regarding weight loss from centers, from Trinity and from our folks at Hartford Healthcare. But the question becomes, is it really about diet and weight loss and weight loss surgery, or is it really about metabolism and metabolic medicine? And that's why our guest is Dr. Charles Cavo. Dr. Cavo is the co-founder and chief medical officer for Pounds Transformation. He's a medical doctor, and I don't know, for lack of a better term, he's been on a mission of keeping people in good health and establishing good health. He was with us in June of 2021, so I thought it was worth checking in. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
Charlie, let's talk. Let's start with, what is really metabolic medicine? What does it mean to be metabolically well?
So I think you could probably get a whole lot of answers to that question, but for us, because we really focus on metabolic health, we're looking at making people healthier in their blood pressure, lipid profile, glucose management, behavioral health. So metabolically, the appearance of labs oftentimes are within reference ranges, but just barely. And a lot of people just accept that. And they'll just be told, let's watch this. We don't really accept that. We don't watch it. We manage it, and we manage it aggressively, because if you just watch abnormal labs, they're just going to get more and more abnormal if you don't take action. And so we really try to influence people's diets and lifestyle in order to improve their metabolic health.
So when we think about, when we think about metabolism, and especially one of the biggest problems in America today is diabetes. Impaired glucose tolerance. I see people all the time who come in with hemoglobin A1C and tell me, I'm under great control. My A1C is 7 or 8, which we know is significantly elevated. And so when we talk about this, maybe it's worth talking a little bit about insulin resistance and how this comes about.
Sure. So that is a really great question. I'm glad that you asked it, because I don't think people know enough about insulin, and they know too much about diabetes and blood sugar. But you can't get to having diabetes or prediabetes, abnormal blood sugars, without first having insulin resistance. And it's a much more complicated complicated diagnosis than diabetes, which people can just say, oh, my blood sugar is elevated. Whereas insulin is a hormone, and insulin responds to your blood sugar. When your blood sugar is elevated, your insulin has to go up in order to bring your blood sugar down. And when people are insulin resistant, they've developed, they're producing more insulin than they need to for a given carbohydrate or glucose intake. Sugar intake. So some people can eat an entire pizza and not gain a pound, and it's probably because they secrete a normal amount of insulin to handle the load of carbohydrates that they'll get from that meal, whereas other people will just look at pizza and they'll gain 10 pounds without even taking a bite, and that just has to do with the amount of insulin that they're secreting, because insulin is a really powerful pro-growth fat-gaining hormone. And so if you're secreting a lot of insulin, you're going to grow something. And in most conditions, and most people these days, it's going to be growing fat cells. So insulin resistance, I think of it more of a carbohydrate threshold that gets exceeded, and then you produce too much insulin, and it just doesn't reset soon enough, and then you feel the effects of it, which is weight gain.
How much of this is genetic?
Did you say genetics?
Yeah. How much of it is genetics? And a lot of patients say, well, you know, we see it all the time. You know, my parents had it, and they resign themselves to the fact that this is the way I'm going to be. But, I mean, can those genetics be overcome to some extent?
They absolutely can be overcome. And I think that while there's a genetic component, and because parents had it, then it stands to reason a person might have it too, but I think a lot of that may be confounded by, they're probably eating in a similar sort of pattern as their parents were. And so it's more diet mediated. And it's not to say there's not a genetic component, because there definitely is. Just like with smoking, there's a genetic component for lung cancer. So you could have a family of, say, you know, five people, four of whom get lung cancer, who all smoke, and one person doesn't get lung cancer who didn't smoke, and maybe they just didn't turn the gene on that would have caused the cancer. So with insulin resistance and having higher levels of insulin based on a given meal, you could be wired or programmed genetically to do that, but you also could opt for a different kind of diet or way of eating that would reduce that sort of epigene from turning itself on and producing a lot of insulin. So I think that there is definitely a modifiable risk factor here if people had the right kind of education and approach to it.
Many times, and I think I know the answer to this, but from your standpoint, but so many times people say they have pre-diabetes. So, and I know you already mentioned watching it and things such as that, but how would you define pre-diabetes or borderline diabetes?
So pre-diabetes is usually determined by a person's A1C being 5.7 or higher. And an A1C is a lab test where a physician gets a sort of snapshot of how well a blood sugar is controlled over 3 months. And so if the A1C is elevated, then it stands to reason that the blood sugar over the course of the 3 months was probably elevated higher than it should be. So you're metabolically unhealthy. However, there are different reasons why that A1C could be falsely elevated. So you have to be cautious with just buying into an A1C being elevated. But nevertheless, A1C of 5.7 or higher is one marker. And the other one is a fasting blood sugar in the morning, higher than 100. Clinicians will use that also as a means to establish prediabetes. Again, I think you have to be cautious with that one value as well, just because some people wake up first thing in the morning and their blood sugar can be mildly elevated anyways, and they can be completely metabolically healthy with regards to how they dispose of glucose. But that combination of an elevated fasting glucose and elevated insulin or elevated A1C, and also some disruptions in a person's lipid panel when you're looking at triglycerides and HDL. If you have that combination or that sequence of abnormalities in blood values, then you're most likely a pre-diabetic and certainly an insulin-resistant person. And if you just are told to watch it, and we'll just continue to watch it, or if you're just told to exercise more and lose some weight, I think that it's a very soft sort of way of treating something that could eventually become a massive health condition for you. And it's a great time to jump on board a pre-diabetic and make them metabolically healthy rather than just watching it.
We hear a lot about medication now for people with obesity and basically the semaglutides, things like Ozempic that people are using. Can you talk a little bit about the use of those medications and how they help? How does that help stem the tide here in someone who may be pre-diabetic or obese?
Sure. So, yeah, the medications that have just recently come out and down the pipeline that are treating obesity and helping with blood sugar control are pretty exciting in the space of obesity medicine or weight loss medications. And I'm sure a lot of people have probably heard of them. Ozempic is a medication. They're all part of this class, GLP-1 agonist. Another one would be Wegovy. So those two medications specifically are in one class, Ozempic and Wegovy. And the difference between the two is Wegovy was designed really for obesity, and Ozempic was really designed for diabetes. However, they both have the same mechanism of action. They really curb somebody's appetite if you're taking them. They're injectable, so you take an injection once a week. And the way in which they work is they reduce the appetite through their effects on what's called the GLP-1 receptor, which is it's a hormone receptor that reduces the transit of food through the intestines, so everything kind of slows down so people feel more filled up. And it also, those medications also cross the blood-brain barrier and affect the appetite center. So there's a reduction of appetite on both of those levels, which is interesting. Wegovy seems to do a better job at weight loss than Ozempic does, just because it's a higher dose of the same medicine. I think it does cross the blood-brain barrier a little bit better from studies that are out there. But they've been very effective with regards to weight loss. The hard thing about them these days is getting your hands on them, because the pharmacies are oftentimes out of that medication. And the other issue is insurances are sometimes not exactly covering them as well as they should. But if you're fortunate enough to find a pharmacy who has those medications and you have coverage, they're excellent. We use them quite frequently in patients. The one thing I will say about them that I see a lot in our office is some people get the medication or start taking the medication, but they don't have appropriate follow-up. And you can't just expect to have weight loss and efficacy from that medication without having some follow-up with people who can help you out with diet and behavioral management also. I guess the other thing maybe to talk about with regards to those medications, side effects. The side effects that we see most often with these medications is nausea. And my patients describe a feeling of sometimes it's sort of like a seasickness. And so that nausea really seems to decrease a person's appetite, and their intake goes down. And that's a calorie deficit sort of way of losing weight. And they certainly work. You can't take those medications if you've had a history of pancreatitis, and you can't take those medications if you've had personal history of thyroid cancer or family history of thyroid cancer. But again, we really like these new medications that are out, and they do a good job at treating obesity as well as helping people with blood sugar management.
Well, you answered my next question about the availability of these drugs, because I hear this time and again, and also I think very few insurances pay for it when it's for obesity as opposed for diabetes. But I want to move on a little bit, because you mentioned, you know, part of this scenario of someone presenting with obesity, insulin resistance, and also lipids. Can you talk a little bit, give us a few minutes about lipids and what everyone needs to know about them?
Yeah. So lipids or cholesterol basically is something that obviously gets screened for annually by primary care physicians. And people know an awful lot about cholesterol, and they get very much worried about their total cholesterol being elevated above 200. And again, they are threatened with starting medications if they don't lose weight or change their diet. And there's a couple of things I guess we can briefly talk about. And if there's anything specific, feel free to cut me off and I'll move on. But the total cholesterol is interesting when it comes to risk factors for cardiovascular disease, but it's not really where the story or the cause of heart disease is. The cause is really looking at the LDL cholesterol and the non-HDL cholesterol. And having those elevated should give a person pause and want to know whether or not they can reduce those values through dietary changes. And in some cases, you can, if it happens to be associated with insulin resistance and you treat the insulin resistance to bring those values down. But sometimes they're not really modifiable, even with the best diet and adherence to the best diet to bring those down and exercise. And I think that really frustrates people when I see them. They get referred over to our office to help with cholesterol management. because we do a lot with metabolic health, obviously a lot with weight loss too. But when a person gets referred over for cholesterol management because they don't want to go on a cholesterol-lowering medication and they're already eating a diet that has very limited sugars and processed foods, there's not a lot more that you can change. And in those scenarios, I think the best strategy is to take a lower dose cholesterol lower medicine, follow the trend, and if you need to go up on that medication or use a different one, you probably should. And I just think that, unfortunately, there's a lot of misconceptions out there that it's simply a diet alone that can correct the cholesterol, because it's not. However, I'm very much certain that in the majority of the circumstances, it's dietary changes alone that can control things like diabetes and prediabetes and metabolic syndrome. But that, I guess I'll be quiet now and see if I didn't answer of your questions.
Actually, I have a couple of questions. One is, we always hear about medication, but patients come to me and say, well, I drink apple cider vinegar or use red yeast rice. Do those things help?
Those things do not help.
Okay.
I don't discourage people from trying them, but if you're using them and you're following the trend of your cholesterol and you continue to notice very minimal changes in your LDL, you can take inventory that the sure. apple cider vinegar and the red yeast it's not working.
Yeah. Does fish oil work?
So fish oil is one of the more studied supplements that's out there, and a very high dose of fish oil, not the kind of doses that you are recommended to take with the over-the-counter one, will reduce your triglycerides. So there's pharmacy-grade fish oil called Vascepa that you can take, and that will bring down triglycerides, which is beneficial. And with regard to just the supplement of fish oil and taking one a day or two a day, depending on, you know, what milligram dose you're taking, it's not something that's necessarily going to greatly change your cholesterol panel. It could have some impact on it. There's some other benefits to fish oil, though, with regards to just a healthy fat that's essential for us to take and helps with things like with our eyes and our neurologic function. And usually it's more helpful than unhelpful to take. So, yeah, I use that quite frequently in our practice.
Charlie, in closing, what could someone expect so that they come to Pounds Transformation? First of all, how do they contact you? And if you could give us like a 1-minute summary of what's the process.
Sure. There's an office number that they can call. A lot of our patients are referred to our practice through their physicians. And there's also a website, poundstransformation.com. And then lastly, there's an open Facebook page that is pretty active called Pounds Transformation on the Facebook. But in any case, a person coming into the practice who hasn't been referred in by their physician will get a Pounds blood panel. So we will be looking at laboratory values like insulin, cholesterol panels, and some others. We will take the first appointment is a 60-minute appointment with one of the providers, doctors, APRNs, PAs, that kind of thing, where we're getting a history and a sense of what's been going on and what's been causing the abnormal weight gain. Because 99% of the time, it's not simply overeating and under-exercising, which got the person to the place that they are. And so making an accurate diagnosis through history taking is important. And then the follow-up after that 60-minute appointment is with dietitians in the weeks after. So our dietitians will see the patients weekly for the next 3 to 4 visits before we bring the patients back to see the providers, where we go over the labs and any kind of medication changes. We try to de-prescribe medicines more than prescribe medicines, but that's how we follow up our patients. It's not a program where people graduate after 13 or 14 weeks. Just like a medical practice, a person who has a problem like abnormal weight gain remains in our practice indefinitely for as long as they want to. So we have patients that have been our patients for, 8 years now. Obviously, their appointments get much more spread out, but we like to keep touch of our patients and make sure that the problems that we're managing are well controlled.
Charlie, thank you for your time today, and thanks for everything you do for our community.
Yeah, hey, thanks a lot for inviting me again. I appreciate the opportunity.
Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board for us today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. If you missed any part of today's program, you can get it on the Healthy Rounds podcast and download it at Odyssey.com. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.